Welcome to the final undisclosed addendum for season two. Folks, we've got two great sponsors this week. They include Audible and Zola. Make sure you listen in for those spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Until then, enjoy the program.
Hello, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. I am John Cryer, and you are listening to the podcast about all things undisclosed. Now, in the final episode of Season 2 of Undisclosed, the team revealed the explosive findings of their year-long investigation into the case against Joey Watkins, and broke the news that the Georgia Innocence Project had built a compelling case for, and was in fact filing court documents, to get Joey a new trial. Now, I am here with two of the hosts of Undisclosed. We have Susan Simpson and Colin Miller. Hey, guys.
Hey.
Hey.
And before I get into the microphone drop that was this last episode of Undisclosed, a couple of events have overtaken us. We have actually got a ruling from the Court of Special Appeals on the appeal that was filed by the state. Now, actually, I was under some amount of confusion because I thought that their filing for leave to appeal was the actual appeal. And I was kind of relieved about that because it was kind of amateurish. I thought, wow, that's the worst they got. My deep misunderstanding of the legal system was showing its face, that they were actually just filing for permission to file an appeal. Is that correct, Colin?
That's right. The state filed for permission to appeal the cell tower ruling. The defense filed for leave to appeal the Asia issue, and today in the order, the Court of Special Appeals says we're going to hear both of those claims, so we'll have additional briefings in February, March, and April, and then it's scheduled for the June session that we'll have oral arguments on both of these claims.
And this could go any number of ways, right? I mean, they could turn down the appeal of the state. Could they conceivably turn down both, or could they grant both?
They could deny both, grant one, not the other. It could be anything.
So if they grant both, what do you do?
If they grant both, then there's still a new trial because if you're saying, for instance, the court grants the state's appeal and finds it's not ineffective assistance in the cell tower claim, but also grants the defense's cross appeal on the Asia issue and finds that was ineffective assistance, then for different reasons, but the same result, we still have a new trial.
Anand just has to win one of the two. State has to win both.
Ah.
And there's still the third claim, which is ineffective assistance based upon failure to seek a plea bargain, which is also going to be heard by the Court of Special Appeals.
At the same time?
Correct.
And this will all be part of one big hearing?
Yes.
So it won't be a protracted thing like the PCR hearing was?
No, it'll be much cleaner.
Yeah, no new witnesses, no new evidence. It's just legal arguments. And then when we're done, John, probably losing party is going to appeal to the Court of Appeals of Maryland, which is the state Supreme Court. So it's going to extend on even past that in all likelihood.
So the state made a big show of talking about some new evidence they had that two sisters were apparently willing to testify, that Asia McClain had been willing to fraudulently testify on Adnan's behalf many years ago. What happens to that evidence that they claim to have?
Right. So the Court of Special Appeals referred that to the three-judge panel hearing the appeal. So there are going to be three judges, majority rules on all the issues we just discussed, and they've referred this issue to the panel. So the panel has to decide, do we remand this again and send it back down to the circuit court to have these sisters testify? I think that legally and timing-wise, there's no way that they remand, but at least those three judges are going to consider whether we need to send it back down again to Welch to have this new evidence coming in, because Court of Special Appeals can't hear new evidence. They can't testify in the appellate court. They'd have to send it back down again.
I'm sorry, this is just so confusing because there's so many threads of possibility here. I have to imagine this is very difficult for Adnan and his family.
Absolutely. I mean, if the court had denied leave to appeal, this is all over. We have a new trial. The state might drop charges. We might have a plea deal. This is probably going to extend it at least a year and a half, maybe 2 years before we get final resolution.
It's still movement forward, though. As much as it's terrible that the waiting goes on, it's how it works for appeals. And this is still in the right direction.
Oh, and just joining us now is Rabia Chaudhry, also a host of Undisclosed. How you doing, Rabia?
Hi, John. I'm doing well. I hope you are, too.
I'm doing well. I'm glad you can join us. Now, just to catch you up, we just got finished talking about the COSA ruling on the state's leave to appeal and how the state has to basically have them both turned down in order to avoid a new trial, that if Adnan wins one of either, he gets a new trial. And is that correct?
Yeah, and I think, didn't COSA also reserve an issue that they didn't pass down? Colin, do you remember? There was another issue that... The plea issue. So I wonder if that's also in play. I don't see any reason that it wasn't dismissed or anything. So I feel like that's also a third possible issue. But I don't know if that's how it works or if they only look at what's coming back up in the appeal or if they can still decide on that third issue.
They can do the third issue, yeah. Because they had the briefing on the plea issue and the Asia issue, and then they remanded the Asia issue because they needed additional fact findings. That plea issue is still there with Court of Special Appeals, and that's an active issue that will be briefed and heard.
So that's three shots he's got.
Yeah.
We just need to win on any one of those. And, you know, I can't say that I didn't cry when I heard it because it's just kind of exhausting. And also because all this time we've known that the ALAs are mostly dismissed and not often entertained. So this is just going to just drag out the process further. But it is what it is.
Oh, so you were saying that leave to appeals are generally not accepted?
Yeah.
Oh, really? Oh, I did not know that.
I mean, even when we had filed our leave to appeal after he was, you know, initially denied by Judge Welch, it was granted after Serial happened. And I don't know if that contributed to it, but when it was granted, it was a big deal. The ALAs are not very often granted. I think Justin said something like it was like 2% of the time. I mean, very, very, very few are accepted.
But as Justin said, this case is not like any other.
Yeah. And also, the other thing is, I don't know if that statistic is true only for when defendants file it versus when the state files it. Maybe they are more often accepted for review when a state files it. So.
Okay. Also with us is Claire Gilbert of the Georgia Innocence Project by phone. How are you doing, Claire?
I'm great. Hi, everybody.
So I'm under the impression that you're literally calling us from having just dropped off the paperwork for this habeas filing.
That is correct. We went to Rome this morning. We collected a couple last affidavits to accompany our filing. Then we went to Walker State Prison, met with Joey, went over everything, and got his signature and the filing notarized. Then we drove to the county courthouse in Walker County and filed the habeas.
And
now
sure,
we are back at the prison.
I'm sure the clerk had no idea the world of hurt that was about to come down on the state, right? She wasn't like cringing in terror as you thumped down the pile of papers.
No, she seemed thoroughly unimpressed.
Okay.
But I think we were the first habeas filing in 2017. They've had one transfer into Walker County, but we're the only habeas filed anew so far. So it's a small county that's, I mean, today's the 17th, but they're not hearing that many habeases, I guess.
Well, congratulations. Now, what exactly is the process of a habeas filing? Just because, as I've shown, I have enormous ignorance of actually what occurs when these things happen. So this directly seeks a new trial, or does it seek a thing like a PCR-type hearing? How does it work?
We are not directly seeking a new trial. We are raising several issues that we believe warrant reversal of the conviction. And from there, it would be up to the prosecutor to determine whether or not to file a new trial, initiate a new trial and a new hearing. What is happening now is that we filed the habeas. We made four basic arguments in the filing. And now the prosecutor has roughly 30 days to respond. And from there, we can set a hearing and call witnesses and try to prove the issues that we raised in the habeas. We have a couple of concerns initially that we can talk about and that you guys may have addressed before about potential procedural bars. And so our first concern is clearing any kind of procedural bar. Joey has already had a habeas, which you know, and in Georgia, it is especially difficult to get a second habeas. They consider it a successive habeas, and it's actually prohibited except under certain circumstances. So we've worked hard to make the record that this does not count as a successive habeas, that it's raising new claims that the previous attorneys couldn't otherwise have been alerted to. and therefore we have a right to be heard by the court on the substantive issues of the matter.
So I was going to ask Colin this, because you do a terrific job in that last episode of telling us what case law actually supports all the things that you're filing in the habeas filing. But what could the state conceivably use against all those things to rebut those allegations?
Yeah, well, there are cases on sort of both of the broad points made by the defense in Georgia that the state could cite. So on the juror misconduct issue, there's a line of cases. The most recent I saw was a case called Murphy versus State, where a juror just this year, the appellate court found he used a lighter to demonstrate a fire, and the court found this was an experiment, but it was pre-existing knowledge. He had been an arson investigator, and therefore that did not warrant a new trial. And then the whole Brady and prosecutor making false claims, the most recent case I found was a case, Washington versus Hobson, which was a rape case, and the prosecution didn't disclose that they had doubts about the victim's credibility, etc., and there were questions about whether this would have changed the outcome of trial. So there are cases the state can cite. I think on the juror misconduct issue, there's no case more on point than the older Watkins case, and the cases the state would cite really don't have much relevance to this matter. In terms of Brady, I think the actual misconduct here is pretty clear. I think the exculpatory nature of the evidence is clear. The tough part's going to be the state, I'm sure, will cite case law saying this is a collateral matter. It's not directly related to the murder. It's related to the shooting of the dog and the placement on the grave. So they probably would have some case law on that. But I think that really that Watkins case and the misconduct by the juror is the strongest argument, period, and I don't see the state rebutting it.
It's a new year, but do you still have the same old commute? Why not let traffic crawl while your heart races with a book from Audible? Let me tell you a little bit about why I appreciate Audible so much. First, Audible comes with me. I can listen to it during my commute, during my workout, when I walk through the park. Pretty much anytime I'm by myself, I put in my earbuds and play from my Audible audiobook selection. In the past month, I've torn through several books, to include The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt, The Hero with a Thousand Faces by Joseph Campbell, and Descent in the Supreme Court by Melvin Orofsky. I'm an Audible subscriber, so nothing tickles me more than when I see that monthly credit pop up on the right side of my Audible app, and I get to shop through thousands of Audible titles that I find interesting. Audible is convenient, it's enjoyable, and if you're looking to try to get through some books in 2017, Audible's going to save you time. And here's the thing, you can't make more time, but you can try to make the most of the time that you have. So turn your commute, your travel, your workout into something more with a free trial at Audible. Go to audible.com/undisclosed to start now.
Now, one thing that I noticed is that because the dog evidence, the grave dog evidence, was brought in under the rule of conditional relevance, who is responsible to keep the prosecutors honest about that kind of stuff? Because it sounds like she never presented evidence that it was relevant, but yet the judge didn't call her on it. The defense attorney didn't call her on it. Whose job was it to do that?
Both defense counsel and the judge. So in this case, the judge allowed for a subject to admission, meaning that the prosecutor was in essence saying, we don't have the evidence yet, but we're making an offer of proof and a proffer, and we'll present it later. And so it's incumbent upon the judge, when that's not presented, to say, well, where's your evidence, or otherwise I'm going to have to strike this and or grant a mistrial. And of course, the defense is aware of what's going on, and they could have and should have objected to the lack of the connecting up evidence.
So is part of the habeas filing pointing out that the judge should have called her on that?
Well, it's a Brady issue the way it's raised here. So it's just saying that the prosecutor had a duty to give this evidence over to the defense, and she failed to do so. And it's more the harm caused by the failure to hand it over that makes this material. Because if the prosecutor had given it over, then the dog evidence didn't come in at all, which makes Joy's case a lot stronger.
Right. Yeah, John, it's more along the lines of if the prosecution had disclosed this, then it's likelier the judge or the defense would have objected to the evidence at trial and had it excluded.
The defense did object to the evidence, arguing it was irrelevant and overly prejudicial and should be kept out. And arguably, if there was knowledge and evidence presented that the weapon that killed Grave Dog was different than the weapon that killed Isaac, that's yet another argument why this is irrelevant and should have been kept out. And if you can keep Grave Dog evidence out entirely, then that is what the prosecutor, that's what Tammy Colston was arguing, was indicative of a signature killing and the calling card. And that was the hatred and the depravity manifested in this signature killing and shooting of the dogs, and thereby revealing Joey's motive to murder Isaac, because he was basically a sociopath who would do anything once he got something in his mind. If you could keep that out altogether, then that highly prejudicial, highly damaging evidence that many of the jurors recall about the trial and there were factors in their decision would arguably have been excluded and not presented to the jury at all.
And to me, what seems most prejudicial about the dog evidence is that if you believe it, if you accept that the dog found by the side of the road had been actually on the grave at some point and that it was intentionally placed there, it rules out the most obvious reasonable doubt in this case, which is that Isaac was murdered in a road rage shooting. I mean, it's hard to get rid of that doubt in this case because everything about it looks like a road rage shooting. And the only way to get rid of that doubt is by showing actually it was a targeted psychopath who was doing this.
As far as I remember, and correct me if I'm wrong, the prosecution did, they said they were going to provide the evidence that there's a connection between Joey and Grave Dog, but they actually didn't. And so couldn't the state argue, well, they never really actually, you know, followed through that evidence. So it wasn't really prejudicial to him because it wasn't an argument that the state ended up actually like making in a convincing way.
But they did use the evidence. The dog itself was the evidence they got in. What they hid was the evidence that would have made it harder to get the dog in.
And they did use it in a convincing way by making that factor in so prominently in their closing argument.
Okay.
And that ties us back to Adnan's case, which is that Supreme Court case, Kyles versus Whitley, the same thing that Adnan is claiming, that the way the prosecution argued the cell tower pings and the Lincoln Park pings in closing argument, that's the strongest evidence of prejudice. Sort of the same thing here. Even if, Robbie, it's your point, the actual evidence was somewhat weak, Tammy Colston really hammered home on that in opening and closing to say, as Claire noted, this is a depraved person who killed the dog, killed Isaac, placed the dog in the grave.
And we know for a fact that made an impact through the conversations with the juror, and especially the one juror that you guys featured in the previous episode, who really clearly articulated that she couldn't understand why Joey would have done something like this until she realized that he is just truly an evil person, as demonstrated by what he did to the dogs.
Just out of curiosity, is it possible that your interviews with these jurors will actually come up as evidence if they do have a hearing?
Yes, it is possible. The process that you would use is, if you don't have an affidavit from the juror, then you would call them, or you may call them anyway, as a witness. You'd subpoena them to testify in the hearing. If they testify inconsistently with a previously recorded statement, then you can use that to impeach them, just as if they testify inconsistently with a documented conversation that they had with someone. For example, if Susan did an unrecorded interview with a juror and the juror gets on the stand under subpoena and says something completely opposite of what she told or he told Susan in the interview, then we could call Susan as a witness to impeach that juror.
And at this point, did juror number 8 actually give you an affidavit?
We did obtain an affidavit from the juror that did the time drive, yes.
Was she ever able to remember exactly how she did the test?
So, again, looking at the record and looking at what a juror would have been likely to hear and understand from that trial, it would be very difficult for a juror 8 to have actually known where the actual spot is here. Because consistently, Tammy Colston refers to it as Chulio Road, which isn't the right spot. It's a mile further to the west and closer to the crime scene. So we don't know where she started, the juror started, or where the juror entered her test, but it's very likely that she did not choose the actual locations involved in this case.
The other thing is the maps that the jury was looking at were not at all detailed, the cell phone map. So it would have been, you know, even if she had a photographic memory and could remember the maps, there were no real streets or details on those maps. So she could well have been starting in an inconsistent location with the map.
I had a question for Susan. Has anybody ever figured out any simulation of how this supposedly happened that actually factored in him picking up a different car? Because to me, all those calculations you made, none of them even seem to take into account the extra time it would need to pick up a different car, which made them all even more outside the bounds of possibility. Has that ever been tried?
By the police. There's a few times where they have jailhouse informants come up with the South Broad Street car lot theory, which is something that comes up later in investigation. It's not present at first, but at some point they come up with this idea that, oh, Joey went to this car lot that his dad owned to get the little blue Honda that doesn't exist. So they try and push that theory, and to me, it looks very much like they developed it based on the timing they had. They just tried to find a way to make this work where he could possibly swing by some kind of car lot. But it still doesn't work. It still doesn't fit the Kingston Tower call. It doesn't fit the actual directions we know that would have been had to be traveled. It's closer. So they do try and work that in there, but it's not a really viable theory whatsoever.
Yeah, my sense is that they did time that drive and distance, but they didn't link it to the towers.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of did it independently of the cell tower evidence, which if you do it independently of the cell tower evidence, it works. But if you use the cell tower evidence, it doesn't come close to working.
I had a question for Susan. At one point, you were trying to figure out why the police focused on Joey so much. And, you know, you went through, was it just that did he have a record of more criminality than most of the other kids? What exactly was it? And it occurred to me that at first the police didn't. Detective Moser had come to the conclusion that Joey wasn't involved. It was Detective Sutton who went after Joey and continued that on.
Well, Moser was geared in on Joey at first. During the very first days, he was also gunning for Joey as well. He did look into other leads, though. He did check out other possibilities. But it seems like Joey was his consistent main suspect the whole time. Until some point around March, it seems like Moser starts backing off from the case. So he also does get literally backed off in that the Floyd County Police join the team. But he also seems to lose interest in Joey as a suspect. Like, there's the note from Sutton proposing an investigation, and Sutton writes, Moser didn't see the point. Which all times up pretty nicely with when they got the cell phone records and did this undisclosed drive test. Which makes me think maybe Moser just realized, too, that the cell phone evidence couldn't work and decided Joey hadn't done it.
Well, also, I remember that Breanne had actually characterized Joey as abusive. Do you think that maybe that's why they zeroed in on him?
Well, we don't know what happened that night at the hospital, but we do know that Breanne was with Isaac's family when the cops were talking to them. So from the very first moment, she was there, and I don't think it's unfair to guess that she was telling the cops, you know, it had to be Joey. Joey would have done this. Joey is so jealous over me. It must have been this. So I think from the start, that was a very strong factor in how the police did their investigation, which I definitely didn't appreciate at first in this case. I came into this case because of what the various court opinions say, what the court transcripts say, thinking that Joey was, like, you know, not the sympathetic defendant, someone who had done a lot of bad things and, like, you know, still got wrongfully convicted. But as you get more into the files, it becomes pretty clear that if this could happen to Joey, it could happen to anyone. Joey didn't stand out in any remarkable way that you would think would influence a wrongful conviction.
I was struck that the juror had mentioned a couple of times that the rest of the jury was living in a crime novel. You know, that implies that they were all sort of trying to dig into this case in a way that saw things in the light of, you know, things as good and evil. And, you know, they were being bombarded with a lot of character evidence. Breanne's accusations of Joey were never actually brought into the case. Am I correct?
They were.
Absolutely. Oh, they were.
And some of the jurors remember it. There's one juror who believes that he recalls for some reason that Joey held Breanne hostage for hours at gunpoint, which didn't actually get testified to. So I'm not sure where he's getting that from. But she did talk about all kinds of stories that she claims that things Joey had done, supposedly. Although consistently, we found a lack of any sort of corroboration for those events.
One of my favorite moments of the last episode was the sound that Claire made when you called her and told her that the juror had done her own test.
She went out and did a drive test of her own, and it convinced her that the state's theory was plausible.
There is this stifled, tiny yelp. I want that to be my ringtone from now on. You can hear her go, what? right. But it's like, but it's great because it's from a distance. You can hear just this tiny little what, and it was a wonderful moment. I thought so. You'll enjoy it.
It must have been a happy Yelp, though, right? It had to happen. Yeah. You know, it gives a little bit of hope.
Yes.
To revisiting the case,
it certainly sounded surprised.
Yes.
Yeah, yes. You were very surprised, it sounded like.
It was more just being startled, too, though.
It's significant.
When Susan told us, not that anybody should rejoice at juror misconduct, but I was like, you know what? This is going to give him another shot, and hopefully a good shot. And so I was kind of really excited to hear about it.
I think I still feel a little, not conflicted, that's the wrong word, but I do, you know, so we put, obviously, Juror 8 in a tough spot now, which I never intended to do. And when I talked to her and she agreed to interview with me, one thing I expected. So I do wish that, I don't know what I wish exactly. I'm glad for Joey this happened, and I'm thrilled that he's got a strong claim to bring to court. But I do hope that this doesn't negatively impact Juror 8, because she was just trying to do the right thing. It was very clear to me that she was probably the one juror in that jury room that was trying to do her job right and trying to evaluate things in a very objective and clear way. And she just felt overwhelmed with the resistance she was meeting from other jurors who didn't even want to talk about it. They just wanted to talk about the, you know, the crazy evil things Joey did. And she couldn't hardly get anyone to listen to her when she started telling them, but wait, the cell phone evidence shows that he couldn't have done it.
Ben Goldberg and I spoke with her as well. And that was, I mean, we got that very clear sense as well, that it was a difficult process that she was taking very, very seriously. She very much believed in and understood the cell phone evidence to mean what we all understand the cell phone evidence to mean. And she couldn't understand why the other jurors just didn't get it and
didn't care.
Unfortunately. Yeah. And unfortunately it was this test, which Ben Goldberg keeps saying, you know, this is why jurors should not go out and do their own, you know, experiments, because, you know, it's not a controlled situation. And she wouldn't have known exactly how and where to do the test to conduct it properly, but it was enough to convince her to change her verdict. So it's difficult for her because she didn't realize she was doing anything, you know, outside the bounds of what a juror is supposed to do. She thought she was being thorough and deliberative and really trying to reach a fair decision. And now, you know, she's gotten involved in this, but she has been very cooperative and honest and communicative about her feelings. You know, she said what happened and then, you know, stuck with it and has been willing to sign an affidavit, which pulls her into this process that I'm sure most people would not want to be involved in. Mm-hmm. So we're very grateful that she was open-minded and honest with not only Susan, but also with us and moving forward.
I think the need that she felt to go and do this test speaks directly to Joey's direct appeal and what Rex Abernathy did and did not do, because they had someone who had driven the routes and timed them and who could have presented the evidence that Juror 8 was really searching for and really felt she needed to make a decision. But Rex Abernathy chose not to introduce that guy, the guy who could have testified, here's what I drove, here's how I drove it, here's the speed that would have taken to make it in time. I mean, if that had happened, Juror 8's questions would have been answered. She would not need to do it herself, and she would have been convinced that, I believe very strongly she would have been convinced that, yeah, it wasn't possible for Joey to be guilty.
You know, I almost feel like she is, this case is Asia McClain, and the fact that, you know, she's standing by what happened, what she did, and even though it's going to be maybe a personal inconvenience to her, it isn't deterring her from just being honest and being willing to provide an affidavit and come to court and do this. And I just want to be clear, though. I mean, for her to not have followed the judge's instructions doesn't necessarily mean there would be any kind of legal repercussions towards her, right? Like from the court or anything like that.
There would not be. Yeah. There would not be. No.
She had no idea. She very much was not aware or had no idea that she was not supposed to have done what she did. She was very offhand when she told me about it. She kind of just threw it in there casually. She's like, yeah, I even checked it out and it didn't work.
And even then, it's not any kind of criminal behavior. There would be no sanctions or consequences because of that, other than, you know, getting subpoenaed to court to testify about it. And then there's one other thing that we just wanted to mention. We ended up getting affidavits from all of Joey's living and still
licensed
attorneys. non-disbarred attorneys. And so Rex Abernathy submitted an affidavit on Joey's behalf, and so did Bobby Lee Cook on Joey's behalf, both of which are helpful in a number of ways, particularly in potentially clearing this procedural bar. So we're also grateful for that and glad that they were able to come forward and support Joey in this, as well as affidavits from Bill O'Dell and Bud Seaman.
What are these affidavits swearing to?
So the affidavits basically say, you know, I was Joey's attorney at this part in his trial and or appeal, and at no point in my representation of Joey Watkins did I ever become aware of a juror irregularity or juror misconduct issue. At no point did I become aware that there was actually a bullet in the dog's head and that that bullet had been extracted and identified. So then the rest of the affidavits say that they had no way to know about the bullet in the grave dog's head being extracted or identified as a different caliber than the murder weapon, or that the Floyd County Police Department had specifically requested that that be done. And they also had no idea that there was an investigative file by the GBI or evidence of a cell test conducted by the Floyd County Police Department, and that if they had known this information, they would have used it to more effectively defend Joey and impeach witnesses. And Rex is also says that he had noticed a change in the jury when the dog evidence came in, that they looked at Joey with sort of revulsion and disgust.
In this episode, Joey talks about that as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, it's been kind of a long, difficult process with prior defense attorneys, as these are when you allege things like ineffective assistance of counsel. But we're comforted and reassured by the fact that they've sort of come forward and are helping out Joey now. So that's great.
Your wedding will almost certainly be one of the happiest days of your life and also one of the most stressful. So imagine the advantages of one site serving all the needs of couples. Zola is a one-stop registry. Couples can register for whatever they want. Sheets, a wine subscription, or honeymoon funds. Zola works directly with over 450 brands so the happy couple can find whatever they want in one place. Brands include KitchenAid, SoulCycle, Le Creuset, Sonos, Ralph Lauren, and more. Some other benefits include it's available everywhere. It's the highest rated registry app on the iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch to register on the go. Love it or leave it. Couples can have gifts shipped now, later, or exchange them for something they really love. Group gifting. Multiple guests can contribute to bigger ticket gifts. Price matching. Zola offers price matching to make gift giving easier for your guests. Help with thanks. Couples can export off their list of gifts and senders to make sending those thank you notes a snap. And finally, love from Zola. Couples receive 10% off the entire site for a year to complete the registry. Zola is the wedding registry that will do anything for love. All the gifts, experiences, and funds you want, all in one place. And now, listeners, you can receive $50 when you register and use Zola. Visit zola.com/UA for details. That's zola.com/UA.
Now, this brings us to a bunch of things. The show raises some actually very troubling questions in terms of the conduct of Floyd County Police and the prosecutors. And it's similar to the Adnan case in that it doesn't feel like there's any impetus for that to get dealt with. Because some of the questions you brought up from the first season of Undisclosed, you know, if the police were in fact coaching Jay through his testimony, that's a big deal. You know, and obviously I have no proof that they were, but that does need to be investigated. You know, in this case, we've got things that are very, very troubling. We've got the secret GBI case number, you know, Sutton's use of jailhouse informants and, you know, was he pressuring witnesses? You know, we've got the DA who, you know, obviously we've got the Brady violation that's brought up in the habeas filing. But it doesn't feel like any of this is ever going to get dealt with. I mean, when do these kind of investigations ever actually occur?
Yeah, almost never. I think the Innocence Project had that stat last year where it was one prosecutor actually being disciplined in hundreds or thousands of cases where this misconduct had occurred.
There's that recent legislation in California where now a prosecutor can go to prison for 3 years for a Brady violation. But whether that's ever actually used, I would be surprised if it was.
Right. But that legislation says that it would be a felony.
Right. Right. Whether it will make a difference to Joey remains to be seen, but I do think that courts do not look kindly on this type of behavior, whether intentional or not, by the prosecutor's office. Because even if by some just bizarre set of freak circumstances that the prosecutor herself did not know that there was a bullet sitting at counsel table during the trial, she certainly had an obligation to find that out from her own investigator, the police department, and the GBI, all of which she should have inquired before affirmatively representing the opposite to the court and the jury.
But the investigator also affirmed it, who actually brought the stuff over. Is it possible that he didn't notice that there was a bullet amongst the evidence?
At first he said no, and then he said yes.
Because, I mean, seriously, I don't know how these things are carried. I don't know how do they just throw them in a banker's box? How does it work, you know?
He had four bags. He had four bags with four kinds of bullet evidence. One was the dog bullets, and three bags were of other kinds of ballistics. So I guess, I mean, he can say he wouldn't have. When Claire first asked him about it, he told her, oh, yeah, Tammy would have seen that because it's written right in the bag. But then when he started to realize what was going on, he suggested that, well, you know, it's a bunch of bags. Who looks at all the bags? But the other thing is, Sutton was sitting there at the table. He was in the court. He was listening to this. He heard everything, and he knew that he'd submitted that dog for testing and ballistics recovery. So someone in that courtroom from the state knew exactly what was going on and said nothing.
Well, somebody got it its own case number.
Yes.
That's very telling as well.
Yes.
You raise an important point about this lack of accountability and the lack of mechanisms to get the accountability. So the question is, and I've gotten this question so many times, and I'm sure Susan and Colin have, like, what can people do when you are faced with such egregious conduct by state actors? Because, you know, if you're represented by counsel and they mess up your case, you can file an ethics complaint, right? And so I've been asked, well, what can you do about, like, some of the attorneys that were, like, on the state side in Adan's case? I think we can also file like a bar complaint, but is that really going to achieve anything? It's highly unlikely. And so even in the case of this California legislation where a prosecutor could get charged with a felony for withholding, not just withholding Brady, but I think there's more to the calculus of whether or not he can be charged with it. The question is, you know, if we can't get indictments for police officers who are caught on camera, you know, very badly hurting civilians, then how are we going to get a DA's office to charge a prosecutor, right? It's like, will the law actually ever be used? Will anybody actually ever be prosecuted under this? And that's
I'm not taking that bet.
I'm not taking it either.
But I wonder why that is. Is it because, I mean, obviously, I have enormous empathy for police officers and for prosecutors. It's an incredibly hard job. You know, the rules are incredibly complex. They're dealing with gray situations, you know, situations where it's not 100% clear exactly what the right thing to do is at that moment. And they know that it'll be under court scrutiny. So, you know, I have enormous empathy for people with that job. They're human beings. They're going to make mistakes. They're going to cut corners just like, you know, anybody in any job. I imagine police are going to, you know, if I coach this guy just a little bit, he's going to be a great witness. And I know what I'm doing is right because I know this guy did it. But all those little things add up and great injustices are done. And plus, there are the occasional bad apples. There are people who there are prosecutors who are trying to pad their resume. There's, you know, cops who are cops for the wrong reasons. You know, it's rare, but it happens. But it seems to me like there's no mechanism anymore. It's like, I don't know if it's the atmosphere that we're all working together, you know, that they feel like they can't do that to a coworker. Because this happens so rarely, I don't know if any prosecutors experience.
Well, it's not so rarely. It's the sad thing.
Yeah. No, now that you mention it, obviously this show is proof. But has any prosecutor lost their career over something like this? I don't know.
Just one in Texas.
Okay.
And he was actually a judge by the time the Brady violation came out.
The Morton case?
Yeah.
But I didn't know that he actually lost his career. I just heard that he spent 10 days in prison for it.
Oh,
10
yeah.
days, which is
but
nothing.
It's nothing. And that's the one example we have. It's a hard, in terms of how the system has worked out here, it's hard to prosecute prosecutors because obviously it's your colleagues and coworkers. That never goes well. I really don't think anything short of a cultural commitment to like norms of due process can help here. It has to be understood that you cannot toe the line in this kind of stuff. Whereas right now, I think there's a lot of agencies and a lot of DA's offices, there's kind of an understanding that you can fudge the numbers a bit and that's okay. As long as you're just fudging, it's not cheating, it's not depriving defendants of their rights. But until the idea that you can't, that everything should be handed over, that everything should be available is firmly ingrained in our prosecutors, I don't see much changing.
Right. Along with prosecutors, what about witnesses? I mean, there are countless stories that I know, and I've personally, I mean, obviously with Adnan's case and others too, I've been in a courtroom where it's, we know the witness is lying. You know, witnesses lie all the time. Sometimes it's because maybe they're misremembering things, maybe they've been coached information, maybe they've been fed information, and sometimes they're just lying because they're trying to get a benefit. And there's no, I don't think there's any repercussion for any of them either. I mean, I don't know of any case where like perjury really comes back to bite a witness in the rear end. How is
Apparently,
Joey doing, by the way?
He's doing well. He looks well. He is cautiously optimistic. I think he's hopeful, but recognizes that we have an uphill battle. So he's doing great. And Ben got to meet him for the first time in person, as well as Rick for the first time in person.
Great. Send him our best.
Will do.
So, Claire, it's fascinating to me that to courts in the American legal system, the process is the most important thing, even to the point where the actual innocence of the human being involved here is less important than the process. And with that in mind, how come we don't have some sort of repercussions when it appears that police officers have committed misconduct, prosecutors have committed misconduct? You know, there doesn't seem to be any mechanism or repercussions for them. Is the Georgia Innocence Project going to be pressing any kind of issues in terms of that?
Well, I think that that is certainly a factor that you see over and over and over again in wrongful convictions and false conviction cases involving innocent people. We, Georgia Innocence Project, has a policy program as well as the litigation work that we do. And so when we get cases, like, for example, if we are able to exonerate a client like Joey or any number of our other clients who have issues of Brady violations and prosecutorial misconduct, that is a particularly good time to come forward and push the legislature to make changes in the laws, to bring awareness to these issues and make the laws more protective of defendants' rights and prevent these things from occurring.
Yes, I don't know why here in California we suddenly got this law where committing Brady violations by prosecutors is a felony. I would love to know the political process that brought that about. You know, it all happened sort of behind the scenes. It wasn't, you know, blaring in the headlines here in Los Angeles, although we have crazy headlines in their defense. There's always crazy stuff happening here that's kind of distracting from the legal stuff. So, Rabia and Susan and Colin, do you guys have any questions for Claire now that you've been at this for a year?
It's hard to think that we've come this far and done the whole season already. It's been a marathon.
It's a marathon that Susan really has been carrying the baton for much of on our end, and she's done really tremendous work. The question I actually have, and I apologize if Claire's actually addressed this before, is what are the expectations in terms of the length of the habeas process? How long does it normally take to get it heard and a decision?
It depends. It depends on several factors. I mean, we could realistically get to a hearing probably within 6 months. Whether we want to do that as opposed to take some time and do additional discovery, see if we can find or develop any additional claims that may lie in anything that we haven't been able to uncover yet, stuff like that. And things like coordinating witnesses for trial, you know, you have to juggle a lot of schedules. All that kind of stuff can push the habeas out further and further. Our goal is to, you know, Joey's been in for an awfully long time. And thanks to the work that you guys have done, we have just a tremendous amount of investigation and documentation already. So it's, in our opinion, we should be able to get this done fairly quickly. Once we have the hearing, then there's an opportunity for briefing following the hearing. And Ben's in the car here, and he's the habeas expert. So I'm going to ask him, let's say you get to the end of the process, Ben, how long does it take for the judge to issue a ruling usually?
It could be a couple months. It could be more than that. It depends on the complexity of the issues. It depends on how fast the parties submit proposed orders. And it depends on how long it takes for the transcript from the hearing to be prepared, because the judges typically wait for that to require the parties to submit their proposed orders.
It's a really tough decision for attorneys to ever make a case public and make records, you know, public and trust like a third party with their client. And so really on behalf of the Undisclosed team and our listeners, Claire, thank you very much. And all the lawyers who have helped us, you know, get through this case and been so, you know, given us all the access to it and brought Joey's case to our listeners.
It's amazing how many people have contributed so much to get where we are now. Without the efforts of everyone on the call now, our staff on the podcast, it's inspiring in some ways, but also just overwhelming to think that this is what it takes to challenge a wrongful conviction. Without dozens of people spending so many hours working this hard, you can't do anything.
Right. And John Cryer. It takes John Cryer.
Yes. But the just absolutely amazing thing about addressing these issues through the forum of the podcast and the way that you guys presented and get so into the weeds on all the issues and break it down and all the legal and factual analyses. I just think, yes, these cases take a tremendous amount of work, but you not only did that work and do that work, but then present it in a way that educates everybody about how complex these issues are and how many issues underlie these types of decisions. And I think it just really increases awareness about the roots of the problem and how these things happen in the first place. And we, the Georgia Innocence Project, are just tremendously grateful for all of your help. I mean, Joey, I mean, he says it every single time I talk to him. He's just so extremely grateful. And I don't know what we would have done without you guys. I mean, we were really kind of at the end of the road with him and the resources that Georgia Innocence Project had. And it's just been a fantastic experience working with you all. And we're incredibly grateful for everything that you've done. And you will, we know that this is not the last time we're ever going to talk to you, but we're just very grateful.
Yeah. We're ending season two, but we're not at all ending our coverage of Joey's case. As things go on, we'll update the podcast, obviously, and hopefully Claire can be back again.
I would love that.
Thanks, Claire. And if you do get arrested today, we'll be your witnesses.
Thanks, John. And thank you, too. We're just very honored to be in your presence and have you educate everyone along the way on this process.
And get educated myself. So thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for everything you've done this season and for hosting all these addenda. You've been incredible.
Well, thank you. I just have to say, as a fan of Undisclosed, this was my dream shot. You guys, I'm serious. You know, to be able to talk with you guys every week after I heard the episodes was just so incredibly fulfilling. And I have such high hopes for Joey. You come away sort of disheartened about the system, but heartened at people's reaction to it every week. So thank you guys for giving me the opportunity to be a part of it.
And I just want listeners to know that we told John at the start that if he wanted to hear spoilers and wanted to hear if it was coming, he could. But he declined for your sake so that y'all could be on equal footing.
But now you can tell me the bombshell. Now, you see, I did a whole season, Colin, but he just disappears. He slinks off. He didn't. All I heard was a little bloop.
He just swallowed the piece of paper. He just swallowed the piece of paper that he had written down.
Oh, this is torture. I'd have to do a whole other season.
Maybe that was the plan all along.
Thank you guys so much. Well, that is it for the addendum. No, really, that's it. We are done for the season. I don't know if I'm going to be able to come back, but I want to say one of the many things that I am grateful for has been the opportunity to discuss and highlight the many, many people and organizations that help incarcerated people and the wrongfully convicted, with a special emphasis on the Georgia Innocence Project. And I just wanted to take this moment to announce that I am going to be matching every donation made to the Georgia Innocence Project by texting Joey to 91999 since the last episode of Undisclosed dropped, up to $5,000. So if you donate $5, I'm going to make it $10. If you donate $100, I'm going to make it $200. If you donate $500, which is incredibly generous, and the Undisclosed listeners have been beyond generous so far, but $500 would bring $1,000 to the Georgia Innocence Project. They are trying to hire a new lawyer. They are $9,000 away from their goal, and I want to help them get there, and I want to help you help them get there. So please, if you can, text the word Joey to 91999 and donate to the Georgia Innocence Project. Now, working with the Undisclosed team has been a transformative experience. I was a fan when I started, but actually interacting with Colin, Susan, Rabia, Dennis, Rebecca, Methil, Brooke, and Hannah on a weekly basis has left me speechless. The diligence, the intelligence, and care that you all bring to bear on making the show is awe-inspiring. And I also want to thank every guest who's been on the addendum. That's Congressman Keith Ellison, Marsha Chatelain, Allison Sweeney, Rebecca Lavoie, Reagan Pasternak, Julie Seaman, Brooke Ginnings, Seema Iyer, Darby Dickerson, Madeline Barron, Jim Clemente, Bill Rankin, Amber Hunt, Amanda Rossman, James Wyrick, W. Kamau Bell, Bob Ruff, Amelia McDonald Perry, Chris Floor, Jill Twiss, Brendan Kenny, Shannon Murphy, Payne Lindsay, Sarah Brewerton Palmer, Kay Levine, Rick Latta, Connie Walker, Monica Bell, and Scott Reeder. You all have educated me, and you've changed my view of the legal system, and you've given me hope. So thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you to the fans of the show. I am one of you. Thank you for listening to all this and letting my clear lack of professionalism not stop you from listening to this. And please continue to discuss the show on Twitter at #undisclosed. And if you want to talk about the case of Joey Watkins, that's #justiceforjoey. Remember, all the case documents and photos are still posted at undisclosed-podcast.com. If you get a brainstorm, let us know. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the handle @UndisclosedPod, and also our key partner, the Georgia Innocence Project, at @GAInnocence. I want to thank Hannah McCarthy for one last time. Thank goodness you've made me sound like a reasonable human being. Thank you, Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media, for audio production. Thanks, Patrick Cortez, for the wonderful music for the show. And Methil. Thank you for your wonderful prep packets every week. They've prepared me and made doing the show a joy. Now, I don't know if Joey Watkins will ever get a chance to hear this, but there are a million people out there who care that you get justice. I believe you are innocent, Joey, and I hope someday that you'll be free. Well, okay, guys. Did we ever get Colin back?
No. He had to run to a meeting, I think.
Oh, okay. Because I was going to ask him what the bombshell was.
Oh.
But I guess not anymore. I missed my
chance. He planned it.
I know. Oh, that Oh, my God.
That's it.
I know.
It was your one chance. You blew it.
Because once you finish your last podcast, you're not allowed to speak to each other after that. That's how it works.